Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It is Tuesday, March 5th. And let's start at the top. First, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 621 and basically not call anyone up for it. What I'm going to do is direct the proponents of the bill, and I don't even see them in the room, but they know about this, and the Oregon Health Authority to get together to make the maybe come to more of a consensus bill. And so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 621 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 363. Madam Administrator.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 363. It's at the request of Senator Bates, I believe, on behalf of another entity, but I'm not sure, which prohibits the pharmacy benefit manager from creating administrative or financial incentives to encourage the insured to obtain prescription drugs from mail-order pharmacies instead of a retail pharmacy, requires notification to the policyholder or the certificate holder of conflicts of interest and other specified financial incentives earned by pharmacy benefit managers, otherwise known as PBMs, from purchases made through the mail order pharmacy.
Okay, I have three for it, five against it, and one neutral. So I'm going to call those who are for it first. Michael Millard, Michelle Belcher, and Daniel Assay?
Acey.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Millard. I'm a professor at the Pacific University School of Pharmacy and one of the legislative liaisons for the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. And we're here today, I'm here today in my capacity representing the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. And as Madam Chairman has pointed out, we're here supporting Senate Bill 363 today. I have submitted some written testimony, and I'd like to sort of just emphasize a few points that I think are important for the committees. The Senate bill basically is meant to preserve the choice of the patient in selecting the pharmacy, and especially the choice to make an equivalent financial decision. In the current market, we're seeing a tremendous amount of pressure for patients to select, economic pressure for patients to select mail order. We'd like to preserve that choice for patients, that they can select the pharmacy that they feel most comfortable with a variety of services. A point I would make about choice is that as you're forced to go to a mail order pharmacy by your PBM, either economically or by a benefit change, and you find that service to be unacceptable, then there, of course, there's no provision for you to move or use any kind of freedom to move to a different arrangement. You are continue to be in a preferred network with that mail order pharmacy. And so really this bill is just maintaining a basic sense of choice. I know that no one likes to continue to get service, especially healthcare services, from persons and agencies that they don't work well with. Further, I'd like to point out that mail order is is an important and cost-effective way to obtain prescriptions, but it's not for everybody. There are patients who tremendously benefit from the support, advice, reminding, counseling, and personal service that a face-to-face interaction with their pharmacist provides. And so just to eliminate that possibility does not serve every member of the public equally. There is a significant minority of the patients who really need this kind of interaction to continue to get the most out of their drug therapy. And this bill would allow that to happen. It doesn't force patients to, or patients that need that contact to suffer any kind of penalty. Second point I'd like to bring to your attention is the PBMs essentially are a monopoly. There is no, as the market has moved, several PBMs have become dominant, taking well over 50% of the prescription benefit market. And so these entities also, as part of their conglomerate business interest, also have mail order pharmacies as part of their business model. And so you basically have a situation where an unregulated third-party administrator is allowed to refer business to themselves. And, of course, this is not good policy. We certainly would object to this if it were, and do object to that if it's physician services or something else, referring to your own lab, those kinds of things, are already not permitted. So it's not a very good idea to have both the insurance side and the provider side being the same entity that we find here today. So we think this bill helps us with that by keeping some competitive forces in the market. A third point I'd like to make is that the committee may want to look forward a little bit, because you have spent a lot of effort to try to transition care in Oregon to a different model, to a different payment structure. And we have a big CCO experiment underway here around trying to transition healthcare to a different model. And the PBMs, of course, represent a very siloed, very counter-transition kind of situation, in that they are completely drug cost driven, as they should be, as a for-profit business. And what this creates the incentive then is to minimize drug costs and not be concerned then with costs on the medical side. So if I can, for instance, immunizations, I would want that to be on the medical side instead of the drug side, because that would increase my profit. That's kind of the opposite of I think what the Senate and the House and the state of Oregon are in the process of doing. And it's when the CCOs get more established and they turn their attention to drug costs, I don't believe that the prior authorizations, step care therapy, the variety of medication utilization steps that the PBMs take will be very constructive, because when the physicians are at risk, it'll be sort of, again, not very useful for them to have to fill out a prior authorization or to select drugs that do not give them the healthcare outcomes for which they are responsible. So, again, I don't think it's very consistent with the transition of care kind of idea. Another point I'd like to bring up is I'm the chair of the Prescription Drug Monitoring Commission, and we're interested in controlled substances and drug abuse. And as you know, this is a major issue for us in the state of Oregon. We have a significant problem with unintentional death due to controlled substances and other things. The problem of prescription drug misuse and abuse is real and present, and Oregon has a significant problem, as is noticed by the recent governor's task force on this topic that convened, and I'm sure some efforts will be pushed forward for that as well. One of the characteristics of mail order is that it does have an incentive to, and some practice to, make it easy for patients to get medications. It increases the total number of medications that any one patient possesses, and increases the amount of household prescriptions that are available. And some PBMs have automatic replenishment models where they push drugs out to the member on a routine basis. And some of this can be found in drug take-back programs, where huge quantities of drugs are given back to law enforcement because they've been accumulated in the home by these sorts of issues. And so again, I don't think mandating 100% mail order is going to be very helpful in the efforts to reduce this sort of total burden of unused medications and prescription drugs in the home. And finally, the PBMs are unregulated, so they're now providing a series of changes in the benefits, which my panelists can relate to you far better than I, because they're on the front line. But this bill is needed to provide some sort of basic regulation for this industry that is going to change pretty much how prescription drugs are delivered. If you think of a all-mail order process, then basically you're driving the profit motive and the normal for retail pharmacies are no longer have a motivation, and you're seeing a huge drop in the number of independent community pharmacies because of this. And so you'll basically end up with a process where the only people who will have a pharmacy will be people who want to have some sort of a nonprofit, market-driven, traffic-building convenience. And you, as profit margins disappear, then so will independent practitioners and pure pharmacy operations. If you think about it for a second, I think you've noticed that your Walgreens is starting to look more like a grocery store. And I think that's because they have to find something profitable to sell. So please consider that as well. So we support this. We think regulation and control of the PBM is overdue. We support it strongly, and we hope that you enact this legislation. Thank you.
Let's hear from the panel first, and then we'll ask questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and committee members. My name is Michelle Belcher. I'm the second vice president of the National Community Pharmacists Association, and I'm a pharmacist and second-generation pharmacy owner of Grants Pass Pharmacy. My father bought the pharmacy in 1973. We're only the second family to own the pharmacy. This year we'll celebrate our 80th anniversary. And it's something that I've seen them work very hard for, and now for the last 20 years, myself and my husband have worked very hard for. You may have seen a copy of this advertised recently, and I find this this quite inflammatory, derogatory, and very misleading to the kind of work, care, and clinical expertise that I give all of my patients on a daily basis.
And what does it say?
The Oregon drugstore lobby versus employers, that we are here to put employers out of business. First of all, I am an employer, and it is estimated that the 153 pharmacies that are owned independently in the state of Oregon employ over 1,600 citizens of our state. So first of all, to allude to any misrepresentation that we do not somehow also carry weight as an employer is very, I find, very derogatory. I would like to say that many of my patients are city, state, and federal employees that have opted for their right to use a local pharmacy and to have the advantage of knowing their pharmacist face-to-face and having someone that they can come to and answer their questions day or night. I'm on call 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And that's something that many of my state police officers that I know in our community, sheriff's deputies, city police officers, that's an option that they would like to maintain as well. And so when we talk about the freedom of choice, it's not to do away with mail order, but it's to preserve the right for each and every one of us to choose where we would like to do our business. And so I am very much in support of Senate Bill 363 to protect the right for every Oregonian to choose where their pharmacy is and who they want to be their prescription provider. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Dan Acey. I'm a independent pharmacist, a junior partner at Professional Center 205 Pharmacy. We serve the East Portland community through out of the Physicians Pavilion at Portland Adventist Hospital. And so this is an issue which I can relate to very clearly because Adventist as an institution recently switched from a PBM model that forced all of their employees who were previously our customers to go to mail order and switched back to allowing them to choose, again, our pharmacy versus mail order. We have a quote that we've provided you. When given the choice, 83% of customers prefer to fill their prescriptions at a community pharmacy like mine. And I can tell you my experience has borne that out. My patients are now more satisfied both as patients and as employees. And I believe that their health outcomes will also be improved due to some of the problems that arise from mail order as a model in and of itself. I'm not against mail order, as my two colleagues here have already stated. I just am for choice. I can talk to you at length about the flesh and blood issues of this, the human side of it, but I'd like to also present some dollars and cents figures. Now, National Community Pharmacy Association is one of the largest association of pharmacists in the country, one to which I proudly belong. And we've, on our website, our national website has prepared a PowerPoint presentation documenting through various take-back programs of law enforcement and in states outside of Oregon some of the waste that can occur when people are A, forced into a mail order arrangement, and B, that mail order arrangement generates automatic refill requests and sends them out not at the request of the patient. We have just several examples of what pharmacy waste looks like and is generated by this arrangement. So $2,800 worth of drugs sent without being requested by the patient. $3,000. $7,000. I'll read a statement here. The patient had died. The family didn't want the medicine around because there were kids in the home. So more than $740 of medicine were returned. And you can read this also on the website or with our lobbyist, Bill. He will be able to provide you with that, the link as well, to really give a dollars and cents aspect to this issue. $30,000 for some of these patients were just wasted drug product that was sent that a community pharmacy like mine that would have noticed right away and never provided and not created the waste to our healthcare system. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Two questions, if I may, Madam Chair. I'm very puzzled about your testimony, Mr. Lillard, about scheduled drugs and about the risks associated with mail. Mind you, I have mixed feelings about this bill, so I'm going to ask some questions, but don't make assumptions about my perspective on this. You seem to imply, and I want to make sure I heard you correctly, that mail order pharmacies continue to refill scheduled drugs even when they're not requested because of the automatic refill services. Okay, but and then you said that multiple people in a house could be getting similar drugs.
Let me give you a clarification. The PDMP is about controlled substances.
Just to clarify, I'm a physician, aware of that.
So that's that piece. And so in that issue, that's kind of why I'm concerned about too many prescription drugs, not just controlled drugs, but all prescription medications. So that, thank you for asking that. Let me clarify to say I don't know what the incidence of automatic replenishment of mail order pharmacies for controlled substances are. I don't know that.
Okay, well, there shouldn't be any, basically, unless federal law requires that every patient for whom I prescribe controlled substances get new prescriptions at least every 90 days. And I can only issue 30 days at a time for patients who are on a chronic controlled substance by federal law, right? I mean, I can't give 90 days at a time.
Are you talking about Schedule 2?
Certain Schedule 3 drugs I can, but generally speaking, we don't. I mean, we don't like to give large supplies of Schedule 3 drugs. Most of us, we don't think it's good practice. So, and certainly, even if we were talking about antihypertensives, for example, even something as cheap and inexpensive as hydrochlorothiazide, which is $4 a month, no matter where you get it. If I had two patients in the same household on the same medication, I'd want them to each have their own prescriptions, right, to make sure that they're both taking the right dose and the right time and stuff like that. So I'm a little puzzled about that argument, and I'm also, I will say, although it's not the bill we're considering, I'm concerned about why we want to expand the prescription drug monitoring program to any drug that anybody sees fit. I'm puzzled about that piece, but we'll leave that aside.
Okay.
The second piece that I don't understand about this bill, and I hope you can clarify, the last clause of the bill says that insurance companies shall reimburse pharmacies, retail pharmacies, at the same rate that they would reimburse mail order pharmacies. It doesn't speak to the fact whether pharmacies can then balance bill patients for what they would get. I mean, for example, if I send my prescriptions off to a mail order pharmacy, then I get, sometimes I'll get 2 months for the price, 3 months for the price of two or something like that. So this is a significant discount for me to do that. But were I to get 3 months at the time at my retail pharmacy, which I could still do with the right prescription, it would cost me the full 3 months' worth. If the insurance company only paid my retail pharmacy for the 2 months' worth, which is what they would have reimbursed for had I sent it away, could the retail pharmacy then balance bill me based on the language in this legislation? Do you know? So I don't think that's going to protect consumers very well either.
I don't think the bill would, in my reading of the bill, it wouldn't really regulate any kind of billing behavior sort of thing. It would simply say that they could not differentiate the reimbursement from the pharmacy perspective. So I'm not real sure what the effect on the benefit would be. Again, this is a very detailed question, and I can. Ask an academician, but the point is that there are benefits where 90-day supply is provided at the pharmacy and the mail order equivalency. I think that's kind of what we're looking for. However, there are certainly other benefits that you cannot get the 90-day for one copay deal except through mail order as an incentive to use the mail. So
what you're actually asking for, I don't mean to interrupt you, I'll make sure I understand, what you really want to say, I think, in that last part is that insurance companies must offer their clients the option of receiving longer-term supplies at a retail pharmacy at the same price as a consumer.
That would be correct.
Correct.
But that's not what the language in the legislation currently says. In 363, it tells them how much they have to pay the pharmacy. It doesn't tell them how much the patient has to pay.
The patient payment is typically determined by the contract through the pharmacy and the PBM. And so that would be not necessarily, it's a contract between the two entities issue, not necessarily legislative.
Okay. I'm a big fan of precision in language, so I guess that's that. I'll leave it be. I'm sure my colleagues have questions as well.
I see none. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. We've got many bills to hear today and lots of people testifying. I don't want to belabor a point, but I will say that I have concerns about this particular language in the bill because I'm not convinced that it does what you actually want it to do and protects patients at the same time. That's my concern there.
Patients, I can say, consistently are charged the amount that is adjudicated and we are paid per the contractual agreement between the PBM and us as the pharmacy, contracted pharmacy. We are not given a choice, to answer your question regarding the 90 days. There are many times when we are not given the choice to be able to supply at the same rate that the patient is offered if they are being influenced at a financial incentive to use the PBM-owned pharmacy potentially and go to mail order. And that's a choice that everyone should be able to make, but they should also have the choice to choose my pharmacy or Dan's pharmacy or Walgreens across town if that's their choice, and have the same opportunity to have a contract if we are not given that opportunity.
I understand. I understand your point very clearly, and I see the validity of your point. I just don't understand the technical aspects as it's currently written. That's all.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And for the record, we did receive a letter from John and Ann Murray, who are pharmacists from Heppner, Oregon, in favor of 363, as well as Matthew D. Loretto from the National Community Pharmacist Association in favor of this bill. And they will be on OLUS. All right. Let's call Cindy Laubacher, Lisa Trussell, and Eric.
There's two here.
Oh, and Lynn Pettit.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Cindy Laubacher. I'm Senior Director of State Government Affairs for Express Scripts. Express Scripts, you may recall, having been here last week, is one of the nation's leading pharmacy benefit management companies. So we manage pharmacy benefits, and we do also offer a mail service pharmacy for our 109 million patients that we serve across the country, and in Oregon, approximately 171,000. We're here in opposition to this bill today, and let me begin by saying with the independent pharmacists, we consider them to be our partner. They're our partner in providing a benefit. They are critical to the benefit that and network that we provide, that our clients rely on us to provide to their members, to their employees. And that's evidenced in the fact that 85%, if not a little bit more, of the prescription drugs filled or dispensed are dispensed through community and independent retail pharmacies, not through mail. 15% or less of our business is through the mail service, is through our mail service pharmacy. So the vast majority of our drugs, of our patients, are served at the local level by independent and retail. This is about our sponsors, our plan sponsors. They hire us, and we offer, you know, a panoply of services, including mail service, and that's simply an option available to them to use. It's a tool available to them to help them lower their costs, and it does provide significant savings. It also provides to patients who are elderly, homebound, the ability to have prescription drugs delivered to their door. It avails them of 24/7 counseling in the privacy of their home. We have translation services. Our labels are available in translated form. We provide labels in Braille. So we offer a lot of services through our mail service pharmacy that is important to most of all of our clients. 363 is about limiting mail service incentives and choices for plan sponsors and patients, and it forces a one-size-fits-all copayment for our members. You know, studies have consistently come out and said that savings and efficiencies are available at mail. There was a Vicente study last year that said mail service pharmacies will save more than $453 million for consumers, employers, over the next 10 years. It went on to say that mail service pharmacies save consumers and payers an average of 15% on a 90-day prescription compared to 90 days at retail. There's a GAO study from 2003 that found the average price of prescriptions through mail were 27% below the average cash price and 53% below the retail for generics. A 2010 study published in the American Journal of Managed Care stated consumers receiving prescription medications for chronic conditions through a mail service pharmacy, quote, were more likely to take them as prescribed by doctors than did patients who obtained them from a local pharmacy. And lastly, to an issue that was raised by the previous panel on the issue of conflict of interest of a PBM owning a mail service pharmacy, in 2005, the FTC concluded in a report that PBM-owned mail-order pharmacies offer lower prices on prescription drugs than retail pharmacies and are very effective at capitalizing on opportunities to dispense. that comes later, dispense generic medications. But also part of the studies, it says, after a year and a half of study, the FTC flatly determined that any self-dealing allegations are, quote, without merit. So we would take issue with the point raised earlier about PBM-owned mail pharmacies. With that, I'll leave it to our clients to speak to the issue, but for these reasons, and I could certainly address all of the points raised by the prior panel, but I'll leave it to your questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with Health Net, Health Plan of Oregon, and we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 363. We see it as a cost driver, and I have Lynn Pettit here to discuss the specific concerns.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Pettit, and I'm the Director of Pharmacy for HealthNet, Health Plan of Oregon. As Lisa said, my concern is that this bill limits the choice of employers and individual members to select a lower cost benefit by using a more efficient provider such as mail order. So basically, our goal as a health plan is to offer options that will help employer groups and individuals purchase more cost-effective benefits and keep the same quality. And it is clear that the mail order pharmacy is able to provide the prescriptions at a lower cost. And so therefore, as has been mentioned earlier, we do offer to our members typically a benefit where they might pay $25 a month for their prescription at retail, and if they go every month for 3 months, that's $75, and then typically our member would pay two copays at mail order for that same 90-day supply. They would have the convenience of it being sent to their home, and as was also mentioned, some of our patients choose to use mail order. They feel that it's an appropriate way to save costs, and as a health plan and the system saves money, so does the individual patient. So we feel that by requiring that there be no incentives to use the mail order, then our members are actually going to pay more even when they choose the less expensive mail order. We want to keep choice out there for the employer groups who are trying to keep their costs down and continue to offer health benefits to their employees. I also wanted to address that we do use one of the large PBMs for our claims processing and for our mail order. And in terms of the service given at mail order, there's a couple points. Our most recent patient satisfaction survey with our mail order pharmacies has come out at 96%, and we do require in our contract that our mail order pharmacy do satisfaction surveys to make sure that we have a service level. And although it's not face-to-face, our mail order pharmacies do offer availability of a pharmacist 24/7, so members can get consultation, those who choose to use the mail order.
Thank you. It doesn't really directly affect this bill, but the proponents of the bill did talk about the waste, and I know you're not regulated, and could you just address that issue? I mean, that's a lot of medication that's being sent that's not used.
What mail order should be used for is a routine maintenance medication, and typically our patients will go to a retail pharmacy for one or two fills, get that dosage adjusted or whatever they need to do, make sure they tolerate the medication, and then subsequently send it off to mail order. So, you know, except in the case of someone being ill and, you know, passing away or something, medications through mail order are typically ongoing medications. We actually don't have the mail order pharmacy use the automatic refills. We let the members or the patients call and get their refills. So we don't have anything automatic going out. Just that's our choice in our particular plans.
Well, that certainly seems reasonable. How about with Express Scripts?
Chair Monis Anderson and members. First, with regard to the issue of regulation, we are, in fact, there are two parts of our business. There's the plan benefit side of our business, and there's the mail service pharmacy portion of our business. The part that dispenses, the pharmacy, is, in fact, regulated. We are licensed by the Board of Pharmacy here in the state of Oregon. We are licensed exactly like a retail independent pharmacy. We do not have, some states have rules that are specific to out-of-state pharmacies, but we are regulated by the Board of Pharmacy, and that's everything from labeling to how much you can dispense at any given time on the issue of controls. All of that we are regulated by DEA about for all things related to controlled substances. So we are, in fact, regulated. We're also regulated as a TPA. And then on our plan benefit side, we're regulated through the parts of the statute that tell a that regulate a health plan as to what a formulary has to look like, et cetera. So those, all of those regulations, to the extent that we have a contract with a health plan, all of those regulations flow through, statutory requirements flow through to us vis-a-vis our contract. So we are regulated on a variety of levels. With regard to wastage and the issues raised, it happens at retail. People come home, patients will come home and have a supply of drugs and it won't work. So they'll go back and get, a different prescription. I can speak to a situation where I have a ill brother who came to live with me with I've never seen so many drugs, this big old thing of drugs, and it was, they kept trying to figure out what do we do, and they kept changing it. So it depends on how you're defining wastage. I don't consider that wastage. I consider it trying to figure out what the right drug is for a particular patient.
Senator Steiner-Harry.
So just to show that I really don't have an opinion, I'm going to ask you an equally complicated, difficult question. When Ms. Belcher testified, she said that her pharmacy and other ones contract with PBMs or other ones to provide 3 months for the price of two, just to use that as an example of how you're doing it, mm-hmm. just the way a mail order pharmacy would. What's to keep insurance companies from doing exactly that? Say, okay, here's what our contract looks like with Express Scripts, and they're offering us, we've agreed to this price for 3 months worth of X drug. This is the price we can offer you. Take it or leave it. And if they can get that, then what would be the argument against allowing patients to get their prescription filled locally at a contracted pharmacy, other than the fact it would take business away from you, and just leaving that piece aside?
And I can answer that unless you want her to.
How about it?
Yeah, so under the pharmacy benefits for Medicare Part D, we have something similar to that. It's called a level playing field type of legislation where we're required to not just have one mail order pharmacy. We need to take all willing providers who are willing to take the amount of money that we pay our mail order pharmacy. So the retail pharmacies obviously charge more on a typical basis for their 30-day supply, and they are willing to reduce their costs a little bit, but what we have found is they aren't willing to go to the low price that the mail order does provide. So currently under Medicare Part D, as a separate example, there aren't any pharmacies who are taking us up on that option. So we wouldn't be against having that available if they're willing to take the same amount of reimbursement as our mail order pharmacy. We would be willing to allow them to have the same benefit.
Okay, so now I'm confused, mm-hmm. and I apologize. I'm trying to make sure I understand this clearly because it's important. But I've got one pharmacist telling me that they contract at the same rate, a retail pharmacy that contracts at the same rate for a 3-month supply as a mail order pharmacy, and I've got you saying that retail pharmacies aren't willing to contract at the same rate, at least for Medicare Part D. Now, obviously, what Medicare will pay for drugs may be different than what province will pay for drugs. I'm just making something up mm-hmm. on top of my head, or Aetna or something. And so that may be part of the issue. But I guess
I don't know. I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay.
I'm just confused. I'm confused.
Yeah, I will say that my VP of pharmacy, who deals with networks, indicated that while retail pharmacies will lower the rates, you know, whatever, the filling rate or whatever, to do a 90-day supply versus 30, he said they'll typically move it into the middle but not go this low. And so the efficiency of scale of a mail-order pharmacy is different than a retail pharmacy. And, you know, many people use the retail pharmacy, and they may do it for those advantages that they said. But there is a cost involved, so that's why... we don't like the part of this regulation that says we couldn't give you 2 months at mail order. We'd have to, you know, a lower cost at mail order. We'd have to either charge you the same at mail order, or we'd have to give members the right to have the same benefit at retail, which would cost more and would raise the cost of the benefit.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank
All right. Eric Douglas and Tom Holt and is it Sean Karbowitz? Anyone.
Chairman Sanderson and Vice Chair Knopp, my name is Eric Douglas. I'm
Cruz.
I'm sorry, Cruz.
Okay, blame him.
He probably will. My name is Eric Douglas. I'm Senior Director of Government Affairs for CVS Caremark, and I handle GA for 9 states in the western U.S. I'm not going to belabor all the points that my colleagues already talked about. We oppose the mail order bill for the exact same reasons that Express Scripts or HealthNet oppose as well. You know, a couple of things that I think I could mention, though. When people came up here that were for the bill and talked about choice, an individual always has the choice to go wherever they want to fill their prescription. It may cost them more money. I think the point that needs to be made is the decision who's going to pay for it. You know, I work for a company, my wife works for a company, we have insurance through that company. The company gets to determine what prescription drug and health care benefits we're entitled to if we choose to sign up. And if we want to go out of network to a doctor that's not in our network, or if we want to go to a pharmacy that's not in our network, we want to go to Costco and pay cash, we can do that. So no one's stopping us from making that choice, but the company doesn't necessarily have to pay, or may not choose to pay for it. The reason they choose to use mail order as a part of their benefit design is frankly because it saves money. And that's really it. There are individuals who do have a legitimate need for mail order. Maybe they're homebound. They like mail order. But frankly, when an employer chooses mail order, it's either typically a option, or it's incentivized, or it could be a mandate for maintenance medication. So high blood pressure, birth control, something that you'd be on for an extended period of time, and you get the initial fill, maybe one or two refills at a retail pharmacy, and then from then on, if you want to continue on the benefit through the employer, you would choose the mail order facility.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Chair Miles Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I'm here today because this bill represents a cost stewardship issue for us on behalf of the 750,000 Oregonians that we serve. Sean Karbowitz is here with me from our internal prescription drug management operation, and he'll speak to the particulars. But I did want to address one question that Senator Steiner Hayward raised about balanced billing. This has been an issue in other bills before this committee, and it's true in this area as well, that if someone chooses to go to a provider not within our network, then that provider can charge the consumer whatever their rate is. We have no relationship then with that provider. Now, in this space, in the pharmacy space, we contract with nearly all pharmacies in the state, so it's not much of an issue. If we don't contract with someone in the pharmacy space, it's typically because there's been some kind of a quality issue or an audit issue identified. But most pharmacies do a pretty good job, and we contract with them. And with that, I'll just turn it over to Sean, who can speak to some particulars of the bill that you may not have heard yet, unless you have a question of me.
Chair Monis, Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Sean Karbowitz. I'm with Regence RX, the pharmacy benefit manager for that serves Regence Blue Cross Blue Shield in Oregon. We oppose Senate Bill 363. It directly reduces the ability of health plans and healthcare purchasers to encourage mail order pharmacy services when it's appropriate. We think it's bad for patients and can raise and will raise prescription costs. Mail service pharmacy is not for everyone under all circumstances, but it does have some potential benefits, and we think that this bill is going to inhibit our ability to provide those services to our members. According to some published data, dispensing error rates are lower at mail service pharmacies than at retail pharmacies. So there are some potential benefits to mail service pharmacies. They tend to have higher adherence rates, whether that's because of automatic refills or whether it's because of intensive monitoring. They tend to have higher adherence rates. Patients who have medication are more likely to take it and more likely to benefit from it. Senate Bill 363 prevents health plans from incentivizing the use of pharmacies that primarily provide medication through mail, from my understanding. It doesn't speak to specialty pharmacies, and there are many pharmacies that care for patients with specific diseases or specific medication needs and will service those patients primarily through mail. I don't know how this bill is going to affect them. For an example, we partner with a specialty pharmacy to provide intensive monitoring for patients with cancer and some other diseases. So the mail, although the medication is delivered by mail, the pharmacist is on the phone with the patient, counsels them on their medication, and rather than auto-filling and shipping excessive amounts of medication as part of the program, they actually ship them more judicious amounts to make sure that patients are tolerating it, using it appropriately, and benefiting from the drug before they ship out more. We've documented some cost savings from that program. So I don't know how this bill would affect it, but it appears that this bill could impact specialty pharmacies as well. So I wanted to raise that as an issue. I don't know what pharmacies pay for medications. I don't see their invoices, et cetera. But according to a Congressional Budget Office report, mail order pharmacies tend to be able to purchase drugs at less than a retail outlet pharmacies do. It tends to make sense to us if we're able to reimburse those pharmacies less that we could pass that savings on to members who are able to purchase their prescriptions at a lower copayment. So if they use a mail service pharmacy, they would have that lower copayment. So that's for those reasons, we think that this bill would increase costs. So we oppose, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Let's go with Elise Brown, Jeremy Bandahay, and Daryl Fuller.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Elise Brown for America's Health Insurance Plans, and won't repeat everything except for one thing that I think bears repeating again, and that is mail service does save us all money. You heard some great testimony from some of AHIP's members and another one to go here in just a second, but I wanted to just say, too, as a patient who's using maintenance medication for blood pressure, and trust me, I need my blood pressure during this legislative session. But I just started doing this because my insurance company said for my maintenance med that I need to do this. And it's taking less out of my pocket to maintain that prescription. So nobody had brought that up. I wanted just to say that I'm a living example of that. Cindy also went through a lot of reports and recent studies on the savings of this, so I did want to say that we've been following that too, and again, just here in opposition to 363, and I'll pass it on to another AHIP member.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehay, Government Relations Manager for Kaiser Permanente, and again, would echo some of the concerns that were mentioned earlier, but also wanted to speak specifically to some, I think, unique characteristics of Kaiser and just concerns that we had about this bill potentially impacting Kaiser. You know, as you probably know, Kaiser Permanente is an integrated model. We have, we're health plan, we have hospitals, we have clinics. We also have our own owned and operated and Kaiser staffed clinic or pharmacies within our clinics, and we also operate our own mail order pharmacy. That pharmacy is available to all 480,000 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington. It's actually pretty neat. I had the opportunity to tour it a couple weeks ago. Within any member, Kaiser member wanting to do a refill, they can log into their electronic health record, click a refill button, and in a matter of usually minutes and usually not more than a half an hour, that prescription is filled and in a crate and ready to go to the post office. And if they're in the Portland area, about more than 90% of the time, they'll receive their prescription in the mail the next day. And we feel that that's a part of what people buy when they sign up and join Kaiser, and that's part of the benefit of being a Kaiser member. That, you know, it's also an opportunity for Kaiser to provide high quality services that are tailored to people who might not have time to run to the pharmacy, and it's also an opportunity to help manage costs. A couple of concerns that we had with just looking at the bill seems to be aimed specifically at pharmacy benefit managers. That's what the summary of the bill says, although PBMs actually aren't defined or mentioned anywhere in the bill. The term TPA, third-party administrator, is, but again, that's also not defined. And it doesn't appear that the bill is aimed at an integrated health system like Kaiser, but just wanted to put on the record that I think it would be helpful to clarify that and ensure that Kaiser's owned and operated pharmacies aren't caught in the definition. Further, Kaiser, albeit mostly limited, does use PBMs in times when a member can't get to a Kaiser-owned pharmacy, and that member also has the opportunity to use the Kaiser mail order pharmacy, and so we want to make sure that there aren't limits to those members who not having the same full access to the Kaiser mail order pharmacy as other members would. And then finally, just as a matter of public policy, since we actually have some experience and own our mail order pharmacy and are able to operate and speak specifically to the operations of it, I think, you know, it has become an important part of providing high quality service to our members, and we just would ask that the committee proceed with caution in terms of adopting any limits that would stem innovation in this area and opportunity to lower costs for our audience. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's go with Daryl and then open it up for questions.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. As I've listened to the discussion today, I'm reminded of one of my childhood heroes, Chevy Chase, who, when impersonating President Gerald Ford, said, "I was told there would be no math." And this discussion is a little above my pay grade. I was alerted about the issue yesterday, and so the reason why I wrote down neutral, I've been told that this could be a significant cost issue for sheriffs if the bill would pass. As you may know, sheriffs buy a lot of drugs, and I'm not talking about just our sting operations. We're required by law to provide any medical necessary medications to our inmates, and as the brick-and-mortar pharmacists here will be happy to hear, we don't let the inmates out to go get refills. We provide that service to them. And so if this were to move forward, we're talking to our county financial people to find out what impact, if any, this would have. And if the bill is going to move forward, I may request an opportunity to create an amendment that would carve out county jails or other circumstances where mail order is the only way our clients are going to get their medications unless somebody brings them from home, and we try to get them to do that as well. So I'm here just sort of saying I'm not quite sure how this is going to impact us, but I'd appreciate a little bit of time to find out, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any further discussion? I want to thank everyone, the proponents and the opponents, for coming. I think you've clarified the issue fairly well, at least for me. So thank you very much, and I'm not sure what we will be doing with the bill, but I'm closing the public hearing on 363 and...
Madam Chair, if I'm signed up for another bill, but I can't stay. So when you see my name on a different bill, you don't need to call me because I apologize, but I won't be able to be here.
Okay, thank you. And I'd like to, let's see, close Senate Bill 363 and open public hearing on Senate Bill 402. Sandy, bring us up to date, but let me first call forward Chris Brown, Shelley Bailey, and Michelle Belcher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 402 again comes from Senator Bate. It specifies requirements for reimbursement covered drugs by pharmacy benefit managers. This declares an emergency effective on passage.
Madam Chair and Senators, I come before you as an Oregonian, second generation. I'm raising four kids here. I came back to Oregon after...
Say your name.
Sorry, Chris Brown. And I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, and I work with Payless Drug. Although I'm not a pharmacist, I've worked in pharmacy most of my adult life. I've worked for pharmacy benefit managers. I've worked for a mail service pharmacy. I've worked for a retail pharmacy, and I now work at a long-term care pharmacy. When you sit at the pharmacy table, one of the most challenging things that you have to do day in and day out is sign contracts with PBMs with no clear expectation of what you're going to be paid. It's as if you're buying a home, you move in, and only after you've settled in are you told what the price is. The bill, Senate Bill 402, I believe addresses a problem in the market in that pharmacies can't get a clear understanding of whether they should participate in a PBM or a health plan because they don't know what they'll be paid. And the primary, let me start with how we got here today. On brand drugs, there's a sole supplier and you negotiate a discount. On generic drugs, there's multiple suppliers and they all produce the same thing. So that you have the FDA saying these four chemicals from different manufacturers are equivalent. To try and manage costs, PBMs develop a ceiling on how much they will reimburse on those generics. The ceiling will vary based on the generic drug. It'll vary on the manufacturer. And it creates an incredibly complex process. And I won't go down the rabbit hole today of all of the things that go on. But what happens is you end up getting a contract from the PBM and they spell out exactly what you'll be paid on the brands. You get a discount, and you can go look up what the AWP is on brands and figure out what you'll be paid. On the generics, you're told you're going to be subject to our MAC, which we're not telling you how we're calculating it, where it's coming from, how often we change it. And you have to accept that, or you have to walk. And since we're an existing pharmacy, working with patients in long-term care communities and patients struggling with mental health, you sign the contract and you hope. You hope that you're going to get paid enough to keep your doors open. And when you go to a PBM and you ask about the MAC, the thousands of drugs that are on it, they ask you to send them a sheet that says, here, give us one NDC. There's thousands of drugs on these MACs. There's no way to manage them one by one. What we're asking for in this bill is a requirement that PBMs spell out what the pricing is so that the market can function. I think the primary effect of making the PBM spell out their market or their MAC is to cast light on how much they're charging and how much they're paying the pharmacies. The pressure will be on the PBM to reduce their margin, not on the pharmacies to take less and less.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Shelley Bailey, and my partner and myself own Central Drugs Pharmacy, a 110-year-old pharmacy in the heart of downtown Portland. We have a focus on serving the needs of individuals living with HIV as part of our commitment to serve the underserved in our community. In addition, over the summer, I was a member of the House PBM work group with respect to kind of dealing with some of the issues that arise today. Perfect, thanks. So today I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 402. You know, in this practice, which we call maximum allowable cost, or MAC, was developed as a reimbursement methodology for PBMs to kind of have a way to provide reimbursement for generic medications. But some of the most severe problems we're having with respect to MAC, specifically in 2013, come from the PBMs that are providing services on behalf of the coordinated care organizations in Oregon, as we are often now receiving in 2013 greater than 90% reductions in reimbursement. So I thought that I would help provide an example to kind of highlight this MAC issue here in Oregon. So for Central Drugs, for a prescription that we dispensed in December of 2012, we received $8 and I think $860 in total reimbursement from one PBM. And now for the same medication, for the same member, with the same insurer, we're now receiving $1.30 in total reimbursement from the new PBM. In this instance, the insurer ended up changing PBMs on January 1st. So I just wanted to highlight this because certainly it's a huge change in reimbursement from that $8.60 to $1.30, something that we didn't contractually change for, but rather solely was adjustment due to this reimbursement methodology we call MAC. And I guess for the record, I should correct, that was $1.80 in total reimbursement. So again, when I say the pharmacy was paid $1.80 in total reimbursement, that is that we were paid $1.80, which also included the patient's copayment amount, any reimbursement for the acquisition cost of the drug. So any labor that's associated with filling a prescription and things has to be paid for by the pharmacy as part of that reimbursement. So the new cost to dispense surveys for the state of Oregon note that in the Pacific Northwest, the cost to dispense a prescription is $12.38. And Oregon did their own cost to dispense survey for the Department of Human Services in 2010 and even noted at that time that the cost to dispense a prescription in Oregon was $10.14. So, you know, should indiscriminate, non-transparent MAC pricing by PBMs continue to be allowed? Consequently, this would result in the closure of Central Drugs. And I note this because over 1,500 Oregonians would end up experiencing disrupted access to pharmacy care. So this is not a minor issue. Specifically for Central Drugs, we work with currently 660 Oregonians who receive benefits from PBMs that are exhibiting the worst of these behaviors. And I also wish to highlight that in Oregon, 76% of all prescriptions dispensed are for generic medications that are considered multi-source. So consequently, 76% of all prescriptions dispensed in Oregon can be subject to these MAC reimbursement methodologies from the PBMs. So, you know, you'll hear arguments that MAC transparency will lead to higher costs for insurers. But, you know, from my perspective and other people in the industry, most economists would know that pricing transparency builds efficiencies in markets as businesses can better plan for and adjust their operations with full knowledge. When both the insurers and the pharmacies have access to the same information for pricing of drugs, a more efficient market will be established. So MAC reimbursement rates are inherently inefficient. PBMs use MAC formulas to help manage their generic effective rates, whereas they negotiate a generic effective rate with their insurer patient, and often through ratcheting down reimbursement to pharmacies, the PBM is able to keep the difference between what they've agreed to with the insurer and the low rate that they're paying to the pharmacies. So inherently kind of keeping the spread on this delta in reimbursement. So now I want to just reference a couple components of the proposed legislation. Section 1.2a. Currently, there are no requirements for PBMs to disclose their reimbursement methodology for determining MAC rates. And as Chris expressed, these MAC rates can float throughout the day, month, or year. So what this means and for the pharmacy is that the pharmacy has no idea what they will be paid until the exact time of dispense. There's also no transparency for pharmacies during the contracting stage to even determine if it would be appropriate for their company to sign the contract. So as Chris referenced, most pharmacies sign these contracts and pray that the reimbursement rates will be reasonable at the time of dispense. You know, and I've heard it noted by OHA staff in the past that, you know, pharmacies can negotiate these rates. All these things are business-related issues that pharmacies can negotiate. But from the pharmacy perspective, I just want to make sure that I provide testimony on the record today that these rates are not negotiable. How can a pharmacy negotiate these generic MAC rates when the reimbursement methodologies are not even disclosed to the pharmacy at the contracting stage? So again, I just want to be clear. I'm not against the MAC reimbursement methodology in general, but just against the fact that these rates and formulas are not being disclosed. So Section 4F. This section requires that the PBM disclose to the insurer the difference between the list used for billing and the MAC rate paid to pharmacies. I can note personally in dialogues that when I've contacted insurers to tell them of the low MAC rates that our pharmacies being paid by the PBM, most of the time the insurer had no idea of these low rates being paid to the pharmacy. And as a final point, I just want to reference that per the language in most of our contracts, pharmacies cannot refuse service. So in the example I referenced at the beginning, where we're being paid $1.80 in total reimbursement, when we fill prescriptions such as this, of which we fill many each day, this is akin to our pharmacy filling this prescription for free, then handing the PBM $10, which is, you know, the amount below cost of dispense that it cost our pharmacy to fill this prescription. So in closing, you know, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to provide this testimony today to highlight the MAC reimbursement policies of PBMs, as these reimbursement methodologies are not transparent, have a devastating impact on pharmacies, but most importantly, are negatively impactful to the community at large when local pharmacies close and are not available to provide the critical care to communities in need. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Michelle Belcher, and I'm a pharmacist and second-generation pharmacy owner of Grants Pass Pharmacy in Grants Pass, Oregon. I'm also testifying on behalf of the National Community Pharmacists Association, of which I serve as second vice president. I would like to bring to the attention that the amendments that were proposed in Senate Bill 402 are mimicking and stating very clearly just what North Dakota has passed in their MAC Transparency Act unanimously. And Kentucky in the Senate has also unanimously passed a similar legislation for MAC transparency. PBMs may claim that provisions of Senate Bill 402 may infringe upon or would force to disclose proprietary information that could somehow be damaging or expensive to the overall healthcare system. However, Senate Bill 402 would not require any disclosure be shared with marketplace competitors of the PBMs. Instead, 402 would simply require that the PBM disclose the methodology and figures information that should be with the interested party or the pharmacy of which they are contracting with. Pharmacies simply wish to know how much that we will be reimbursed and how such reimbursement is developed. This would be a common business practice in any other business, and it almost seems silly to me that we're having to ask to have common sense type of business practices so that I may maintain my business. Also, if a pharmacist or customer of the PBM notices that a given figure appears to be flawed, Senate Bill 402 would provide with reasonable recourse to correct the error with the PBM through a defined appeals process, which currently does not exist. Currently, you may write continued excessive amounts of letters of which you get no response because there is no formal appeals process with which they have to abide. So this would clarify and define that appeals process. NCPA and myself completely agree with the confidentiality and that it should remain intact throughout the process and be it between the pharmacy contracted with the PBM only. Again, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Senate Bill 402, which I am in strong agreement with. Thank you.
Just to ask specifics on the bill, which evidently gives PBMs heartburn. One is that in the Section A, 4A, that there has to be at least three nationally available drugs So that means if there aren't three on the generic on the list, they and you had two, they would have to be treated as a brand name. And to me, that just doesn't make sense. And I don't know why you chose three. And then on the second page, having the MAC within 7 days when there are thousands and thousands of drugs may just be impossible. I don't know in being able to update. So those are things that, at least preliminary, the opponents of the bill said, would you be willing to work on at least changing some of those parameters? Of course, maybe the PBMs don't want this bill at all, but those were the main concerns.
Madam Chair, I would definitely think that the PBMs here don't want this bill at all. The reason for three drugs selected is that so that you have real competition. When a drug comes off patent, you have typically one generic available and you have the branded product. So there's two chemicals, one sold as a brand, one sold as a generic, that are available. Most of the time, those can't be matched because there's no real competition. There's a brand and a generic, so there's no way to set a fair ceiling. You need multiple suppliers so that there's generic competition, and that's why we chose three. In terms of what happens to the generic, most prices, most PBM contracts say you'll get this for brands, you'll get this discount for generics, or it's on a MAC. And as we've already discussed, that what's on the MAC and what's not isn't spelled out, but at least you know if the drug's not on it, you're getting some kind of a discount, and that discount's typically less than what you're paying on the brand. And the AWP, the cost of that generic, even if there's only one, it's going to be cheaper than the brand drug.
What about the 7 days?
I can provide a response to that. The pharmacies, we're invoiced daily for the drugs we receive, and the vendors and wholesalers we work with are clearly able to adjust pricing daily based on market conditions. Also, not only do pharmacies receive data files with respect to industry pricing, but PBMs receive these same data files. So from my perspective, the 7-day limitation should not be a challenge.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As opposed to probably to Ms. Belcher, right?
Yes.
You had testified on the previous bill that you had concerns about the lack of arm's length relationship between PBMs and insurance companies. I think it was you. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Did you express some concerns that the PBMs, there were some PBMs that were owned by insurance companies and that presented a potential conflict?
I don't believe I had.
It wasn't you.
No, I apologize.
Okay.
No.
All right.
Okay.
I thought I'd heard that.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, could I just add one thing that I neglected? In my nervousness sitting in front of you for the first time, I didn't put this in. I'm a registered independent in Oregon, but I believe passionately in markets. I don't believe in businesses putting their thumb on the scale. I believe the competition is how we all benefit. And the MAC is a situation where the PBM has all of the cards. They know what they're going to charge. And I'm in a position where I either have to take it or leave it and stop helping the patients that we serve. Last year, Walgreens took on Express Scripts and dropped out of their network. They lasted 6 months. And they came back. And I'm sure if we dig through the press releases, it was a real love fest when they got back together. But the fact is, if Walgreens, the nation's largest pharmacy chain, can't negotiate effectively with a PBM like Express Scripts, how can you realistically expect community pharmacists and pharmacies like the one sitting in front of you? This bill saying we're out to raise prices on small business and business in Oregon, we are small business in Oregon. We drove down here. We drove up here from Grants Pass. We came down here from Portland. We didn't fly in from out of state. We didn't have to bring along people with us. We want to make sure we get enough to keep our doors open. And all we're asking is some disclosure from our Express Scripts business partner who apparently really values us so much that they can't even send us the pricing they're willing to pay us. And I'm sorry if I'm a little bit emotional about this, but this is something that's near and dear to me and every pharmacist who's here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Jeff Harder, and then...
he's bored, right?
Yeah. And then Amy Bricker and Eric Douglas. But Jeff Harder first.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Harder. I am former owner of West Main Pharmacy in Medford. I no longer own the store, but I do continue to work there as a pharmacist. I'd like to just provide some clarification as to the impact that the MAC prices and substandard reimbursement typically results in at the pharmacy level. Once we sign a contract, we are obligated to dispense the medication. We cannot see a substandard reimbursement and go to the patient and say, I'm sorry, aren't paying us enough for this. We can't fill this for you. We have to dispense it. And so whatever they tell us on the electronic adjudication that they're going to pay, that's what we receive. So I asked the current owner of the store to provide me with a report which showed the first 8 weeks of this year. And asked him just to give me a listing of all the prescriptions that we filled that our total reimbursement, including our dispensing fees, was below our actual acquisition cost. He provided me with a list, which you should all have, of 670 prescriptions that we filled in an 8-week period, resulting in a loss below our cost in excess of $7,000. If you extrapolate that 8 weeks out to the course of an entire year, that means we are going to lose $45,000 filling prescriptions and providing medications to our patients. It takes a full person or two people, two techs in our store. That's the only way we can make up for that is by having less staff. We can't control a lot of our expenses. The only way that the pharmacies today can try and combat that is to have less staff, which means that each one of us has to do more and more work just to maintain the status quo. So that's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. So Amy Bricker and Eric Douglas aren't here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Bricker. I am Senior Director of Provider Relations and Strategy for Express Scripts, here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 402. So the proponents of the bill did a pretty good job, I think, of explaining really what the issue is relative to MAC. Just to restate a couple of points, in the industry, since the mid-80s, it's become more of an industry standard to contract with pharmacies and to reimburse pharmacies based on MAC, or maximum allowable cost. This is because there is no other alternative in the industry with respect to reimbursement of generics. This is because if you reference an AWP benchmark, there are so many manufacturers that pharmacies would indeed be incented to buy the drug that has the highest AWP versus attempting to acquire the drug with the lowest cost. And so it is our responsibility as management of the pharmacy benefit to ensure that pharmacies actually are acquiring the lowest cost drug for the members that they serve and our clients. A couple of additional points is Senate Bill 402, because it would limit to the three therapeutic equivalents, would not allow our clients to benefit from the drug that comes off patent. If you think about Lipitor and atorvastatin, there actually is a difference in AWP between branded Lipitor and atorvastatin when it came off patent. And so while the MAC was different at the beginning of that period versus today, it is actually necessary in managing the cost and reimbursement of that drug, as one example. It would increase prices for older, deeply discounted drugs, drugs like potassium chloride or phenobarbital or digoxin, drugs that have been around for eons that are deeply discounted. It would actually remove those from being able to be MACed. It would imply that as payers and as insurers that we actually have knowledge of the pharmacy procurement agreements and arrangements. And if we did, in fact, that would be have anti-competitive and antitrust concerns, obviously. It would require the disclosure of proprietary information. And in this highly competitive marketplace where PBMs are competing, where clients are attempting to continue to reduce spend relative to pharmacy spend, it would actually increase total costs if we're having to disclose that information. We actually do update our lists on a frequent basis, but it would, the bill as written would suggest that all pharmacies be treated equally, and we don't actually believe that to be true. So it suggests that if I make a change to a MAC list, it should apply to all pharmacies. I don't reimburse pharmacies equally. So how I reimburse a Walmart is differently than how I would reimburse an independent pharmacy. Their buying power just isn't the same. So does it make sense? And it would increase costs. And lastly, it requires for retroactive adjustment of prescriptions. Prices if there is an appeal and that appeal is granted. The issue here is really more of an audit concern. So from a PDE record on the Medicare Part D side, those prices that were set maybe weeks, months ago, if they're changed, it causes an inaccuracy then in that record for that patient. Express Scripts recognizes and agrees that, as mentioned here today, I'm not going to argue that there aren't times that a pharmacy is reimbursed at or below their acquisition cost, but I do know that there are more drugs that are reimbursed to them at a higher margin. In Oregon, pharmacy is a thriving and strong business. We contract with over 670 pharmacies in Oregon, over 200 independent pharmacies, and that number actually is increasing year over year. Last year alone, I received 15 applications for new independent pharmacies to join our network. So they aren't going out of business, and they're actually continuing to thrive in the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz. My name is Eric Douglas. I'm Senior Director of Government Affairs for CVS Caremark. I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 402 for the same reasons that Amy stated. A couple of things that I would like to point out. I think it's been a common misnomer that there is one or just a couple of MAC lists. There are MAC lists for every client that we have. And to produce a document or a file for the MAC prices. So let's talk about the contract. When you're looking at your contract for PBM services and you're a pharmacy, we can tell you what we're going to reimburse you for a brand drug, but we reference MAC for the generics that you can MAC because if we produce every MAC for every client in the state, it would be a 10,000-page document. And it would be out of date within a couple of days. Not all of the prices, but some of the prices. So what does a pharmacy do? What they said is correct. When they adjudicate the claim, that's when they know what the reimbursement will be. They're also correct that every price is not profitable for the pharmacy. The contract guarantees that you'll make money across the mix of the contract. You're not going to necessarily make money on every single generic drug that you reimburse. Moreover, we will overpay on many generic drugs, and we don't come back and try to ask for a percentage of that money back. But we do, in fact, allow for a procedure for pharmacies to, if they can produce an invoice and show us that they're actually buying for less than what we're reimbursing them, we will pay them that money from that date forward, from when they made the claim forward. And again, this bill would require that that would apply across all pharmacies. And as Amy stated, all pharmacies are not equal. You wouldn't want to reimburse what an independent pharmacy can purchase a generic drug for is much, much different than what Walgreens or Walmart can purchase a generic drug for, because they're a commodity, and if you can buy 10 million units of any commodity, you're going to be able to purchase more. Some independent pharmacies can pool together through PSAOs, which is a group purchasing organization, and that helps them have some leverage, but independent pharmacies do not buy as efficiently as your large chains. But we believe that our MACs are fair, and we ran through the numbers for the last several years. 1/100,000th of 1% is the percentage of generic claims that that independent pharmacies or any pharmacy will ask for money back on, or will say, you didn't pay me enough, here's my invoice to prove, across the 10 million prescriptions that we would produce or that we will run through our system in a given year, the percentage of complaints that we have about pricing is approximately 700.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember when we were hearing testimony on the All Claims, All Payer database in the past that I think the health authority argued that the more we know about claims payments and practices, that would have a downward pressure on price. And I think part of the challenge here is there's so much price discrimination and variation between the service that you get on one side of the street and the service you get on the other, that whether it's pharmacy or whether or not it's, you know, the hospital in Bend being able to charge three times as much as a procedure in Portland, it's a big challenge. What I don't quite get in when a health insurance company is contracting for a particular CPT code or procedure, it's proprietary information. The insurance company says it's proprietary. It's forbidden for one provider to share what they are getting paid to another. It's considered anti-competitive. But you're arguing that you can't even release that information of what they will be paid to the pharmacy themselves. Couldn't you set up the same kind of sideboards in the contract that they couldn't tell their competitors what they were getting reimbursed? Or is there something peculiar to the MAC world that I'm not getting?
That's interesting. To answer your question, Madam Chair and members, if a pharmacy calls and requests a MAC from Express Scripts, we provide it. The issue is that as soon as I give it to you, it's outdated. There are thousands of MAC lists. And so absolutely, without a doubt, unequivocally, I would challenge anyone that says that it's not available to them. It is. It's just outdated as soon as it's released.
So, Madam Chair, to follow up, there's no way that they could feasibly be told ahead of time. That's what you're arguing, right? That, and they're expected to just go into contract on kind of good faith that they will be reimbursed adequately.
Madam
without
Chair,
knowing the amount that they'll get reimbursed.
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, they would know the day that they request the list. However, it would change. Our contracts are for a set period of time, and they have the right to terminate that contract if they were maybe going out of business or not able to be profitable. That's not happening. They have appeals process that they can also, as referenced previously by Eric in testimony, we only received 75 appeals in the state of Oregon out of 7 million claims processed. And so there are opportunities and options for independent pharmacies, or any pharmacy for that matter, to request additional information relative to MAC. But as stated, it's available to them, but it will change.
Yeah. And my last follow-up question. So you work for CVS Caremark, is that
yes.
right? So the two of you combined, what proportion of all of the business would you say you own in the state of Oregon?
I don't know what you own.
I don't know what our market share is in Oregon. I can get
across the country, what's the ballpark figure?
Madam Chair and Senator, Express Scripts manages one out of every three households in the United States.
And we manage about 100 million lives. So one out of three. Do you also do about one out of three or more?
Well, there's 310 million people in the United States. So if you have 100 million.
We have 100 million also.
And you have 100 million. That's two-thirds of the market right there.
So I, part of my concern is that I don't think there's a whole lot of other places for them to go.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
I have an honest to God, please don't read anything into it, educate me question, okay? I get puzzled enough when I see gasoline prices going up and down and up and down and up and down every single day, all right? And I really don't understand why the MAC lists change on a day-to-day basis, because if I were buying screws, a certain size screw, at my hardware store, even if it's a big chain store, and their price was changing potentially, I don't believe that their price from their wholesaler would change every day anyway, but I could be wrong about that, or their manufacturer would change every day. I don't understand why the price of drugs fluctuates so much. Am I missing something? I'm completely puzzled. I had no idea, even as a physician, that they change that much that fast. Help me understand that piece of this puzzle.
Madam Chair and Senator, I'll take a run at it and then pass it to Eric. When we're bidding with a client to manage their prescription benefit, they're essentially telling me what they're willing to pay my retail pharmacy network for prescriptions. That's why we have thousands of MAC lists. It's very client-specific relative to what they're willing to reimburse.
Okay, I get that part of it. But if you have a contract with Aetna, mm-hmm. pick a large insurer, that contract and what they're willing to pay doesn't change every day, does it?
I can't speak to Aetna's.
Seriously. I mean, I'm not trying to be difficult here, but really, it can't be reasonable for Express Scripts to be negotiating on a daily basis with Aetna as to how much Aetna is willing to pay for a medication, right?
No, you're correct. At the beginning of the contract, they tell me what they're going to pay for the life of the contract.
So why would the MAC list for Aetna patients change? If you set up your contract with Aetna on January 1st, 2013, and it's for a year,
mm-hmm.
pick a magic number,
mm-hmm.
then why would that MAC list change and become outdated? Why couldn't a pharmacy have that information available to them and know that that was going to be consistent for all the Aetna patients for the rest of 2013? There may be a really compelling reason that I'm completely missing here. I'm really not trying to be difficult. I just don't understand.
No offense taken. It's very complex. And so the issue truly is that we're managing to a guarantee that our clients hold us to, and therefore we're reimbursing the pharmacies accordingly. The market can change overnight, so there can be a drug shortage overnight. So what I said I'm going to pay for amoxicillin today is very different than what I would pay for amoxicillin potentially if all the manufacturers had a production problem, as seen with doxycycline this year. And so because I say I'm going to pay you a dollar today, doesn't mean I'll be able to pay you a dollar tomorrow.
Okay, but isn't that, from a business practice, the risk that PBMs take as part of the business of managing these contracts? I mean, you are, in essence, taking on risk, right? That's the whole point of a PBM business. You're supposed to be taking on risk and managing this very large pool, I mean, 100 million lives, this very large pool of patients. You're essentially taking on the risk of managing all of their prescription medications, right? That's what PBMs do?
We align ourselves with our clients, so when they save money, we make money. And
okay, but so you're saying that you're making a contract with the pharmacy, but you're not guaranteeing them to pay them a dollar for amoxicillin. You're guaranteeing them to pay the percentage of what you pay for amoxicillin?
Depends on the contract. So if it's a pass-through arrangement, which a large portion of our business is a pass-through arrangement, meaning whatever I pay the pharmacy, I bill my client. that varies based on, again, most of the variance really comes in the availability of the product in the marketplace. When there are a number of manufacturers and we have insight into what the acquisition cost range is, we're setting the price accordingly, and that literally changes every day.
Okay, so I'm not going to belabor this anymore, but I'm going to need some more education on this, because essentially what I think you I hear you telling me is that the price of amoxicillin varies as much as the price of what used to be the standard pork bellies on the Chicago Trade Exchange. We don't trade pork bellies on the Chicago Trade Exchange anymore, but
when did they stop?
About 18 months ago, 2 years ago. It stopped being something that...
Damn.
Yeah, well, I'm just reporting, Cruz.
We have one more bill, so
okay.
Let's...
So that's what I'm... That's what I... Just surprises me. That's all.
May I add one last comment before... Madam Chair and Senator Stein, Senator Hayward, I think... the point we're trying to make, it's not about... The entire list is not outdated tomorrow, but every MAC list for every client, so what I'm saying is every single drug on that list will not be correct within a day or 2 days. I'm not saying every single drug, every price on that MAC list will change. That's not true. But to say that this document you've handed me is accurate to every price, that I couldn't guarantee in 2 days, because the price of the availability of the generic on the market may change. And our fiduciary, we do not take risk. We're not an insurer. But what we do is have a fiduciary duty to our clients to afford them the least, have them pay the least amount of money for a prescription drug available on the market. And since brands are a monopoly, you're going to pay whatever the brand manufacturer wants. But generics being generic, a commodity, right. That price fluctuates. And when the price does fluctuate and we have a client, we have a fiduciary duty to all of our clients, that's when we adjust the price. And the pharmacy, they're right, that they will not know until they adjudicate the claim. But if we send them, it's about the sheer volume. There's about 8,000 generic drugs, I think. 8,000, is that about right? So 8,000 across, 8,000 drugs across 2,000 or 3,000 clients across, and multiple MAC lists so what is that, 8,000 times?
Okay,
it's just an enormous number.
Okay. I won't believe this anymore. I know we've got other
things
to do.
Thank you very much. And now we'd like to call up Tom Holt and Sean Karbowitz.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Tom Holt again on behalf of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I want to take just a moment to walk through a bit of the competitive background on how the drugs get to the generic market and purchasing that takes place, and I'll turn over to Sean to speak to the bill particularly. When a drug is coming off brand exclusivity, the first generic manufacturer gets a six-month exclusivity period. So then you have two suppliers. When that six-month period ends, then it's all comers, and it becomes a commodity. And that market is very, very competitive. In one of my past lives, I sat on the board of one of the largest generic purchasing organizations in the country. And I can tell you from my experience that the manufacturers of the generics beat each other's heads in trying to get that business of those purchasing organizations, which savvy pharmacies, whether they're independent or chain, tend to be part of. If you're a big enough chain like a Walmart, you buy on your own. But most pharmacies have the ability to participate in these purchasing organizations. They are not helpless here. The MAC system has existed for roughly a generation. And it is designed, as an earlier witness pointed out, to not necessarily ensure every single product is purchased at providing a margin, because it's not possible to do that in a market where manufacturers may jump in and out of supplying that drug almost day to day. You can go from having six suppliers to only having two or three very, very quickly. But as a whole, the pricing system is designed not to rip off pharmacies, but to ensure, one, that they do get reimbursed fairly, and two, that they are held to account to ensure that they're really engaging in good business practices on the purchasing side, so that they're, you know, they can't just rely on whatever price is given to them. That they do have options in the marketplace to purchase from other sources. With that, I'll turn over to Sean.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Sean Karbowitz with Regents Rx, the pharmacy benefit manager for the Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon Health Plan. We stand in opposition to Senate Bill 402. It will raise costs for the over 300,000 Oregonians that have prescription benefits through us. MAC pricing is used, as Tom mentioned, MAC pricing has been used for quite some time in every state of the country, and the point is really to incentivize pharmacies to be judicious and make good purchasing decisions and inventory managing decisions when they're buying medications. It's a tool, the MAC pricing is a tool that helps our employers, the employers that we serve and their employees and members and Oregonians get the most competitive market-based prices available. Senate Bill 402 benefits pharmacies and not consumers or patients. Senate Bill 402 allows pharmacies to buy drugs at a very low discounted rate and yet be reimbursed at a much higher, significantly higher rate. It will increase the prices for other drugs by simply removing them from the MAC, from what could be MAC'd. In total, this means that sponsors will pay more for drugs and consumers will end up paying more. A couple of things that I noticed in the bill, it has an interesting definition of therapeutically equivalent, and it differs from what pharmacists are typically able to substitute at a pharmacy. So what this kind of does is there's a pool of generics that pharmacists can substitute, and this definition of what could be applied to them to a MAC, or what a MAC could be applied to, is smaller. So therefore, again, there's drugs that could be excluded from that that MAC list. So I'll take questions. Happy to take questions.
Seeing no questions, thank you very much. I see the concern that our independent pharmacies have. It's very hard to compete with the Walgreens, Fred Meyer Pharmacy, et cetera. And this MAC pricing is far more complicated than I ever thought. And again, I'm still not quite sure how those prices can change so rapidly on a daily basis. But this bill is not prime time. It would need some work. If the proponents are willing to work with the opponents, I think that we all would be willing to look at some amendments if that's so desired. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 402. And Mr. Chair,
I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 601 and call to the dais Senator Mona Sanderson, whoever she is. Is she around?
I think she just left.
Oh, okay.
She can introduce the bill.
The only one.
Clear the room.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me. I guess I allowed myself to speak. Senate Bill 601. And I will be the only one testifying on this. Oregon is only one of six states.
Lori, we need your name.
I always forget that. I'm State Senator Lori Mona Sanderson, representing Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview.
I mean, I knew who you were, but okay.
And I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 601.
Okay.
And this, in reading some of the magazines from NCSL, I found that Oregon is only one of six states that does not have a medical or education consent law. And again, our children are so important But we are in such a mobile society, and there are so many issues that many of our children are not living with their parents. And for children not living with their parents or whose parents are unable to care for them, there are 41 states and Washington, D.C. that allow caregivers to enroll them in school or make health care decisions on their behalf, even though they are not their legal guardians. So there's a number of reasons why children don't live with their parents. Drug and alcohol, mental illness, AIDS, abuse and neglect, they're in prison or they're deployed. And so this bill is just trying to cut down some of the barriers that might be that some people who are caring for these children run into. My neighbor is raising their grandchildren. They will not talk to us about the parents of the grandchildren. But our children need medical and mental and dental care. And basically what this bill does is it would allow an affidavit to be signed by the caregiver. And this is just relative caregiver. I mean, there are some states that you don't have to be a relative. But you have to make sure that if you read the bill closely, basically that there are certain things that they would have to fill out to take to, say, the school. And you would have to have the name of the minor child, the child's date of birth, the relative caregiver's name and date of birth, and the address at which the relative caregiver lives with the minor, the relationship of the caregiver to the minor, the Oregon driver's license, and the contact information of the legal parent or guardian. There must be an attempt to contact the legal parent or guardian. It has to be described. And therefore, a child would be able to get health care and or be admitted into a school. So that's basically what the bill does. And there's no one else to testify on the bill, unfortunately. But it would be nice to know what your feedback is on that.
So, Madam Chair, what you're talking about, you're not talking about a situation where DHS has come in and removed a child from a home. You're just talking about where, for some reason, the parents have said, Grandma, can you take care of this kid?
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about kids that are actually in the system in any way.
No, not at all.
Chip's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. It makes sense to me, particularly with DHS's movement that we hear every time there's a child welfare bill in front of us about how they're trying to reunite families and keep them together. But that might not always mean that, you know, the custody and the custodial parent record follows to whoever's taking care of them. So it makes sense to me. I thought everybody was here for that.
No.
You know who your friends are, right? I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Do you have a sense, Senator, about whether this would apply for very temporary situations? I mean, if miracle of miracles, my husband and I were able to get away for a weekend together and we left our kids with my in-law. Yeah, I'm not.
Okay.
And besides, it's long past because my kids are old enough to be by themselves. But, you know, when they were little, if we left them with my in-laws for the weekend, and then it would have applied in that
situation. That's what it would be applying for. Yeah, it would have applied.
Okay.
My brother took care of my son and daughter, and my son got very sick. They waited till I got back 3 days later, and he was just very, very, very sick. And I still don't forgive him for not taking him, but I wasn't there. I had written out something, though. I don't know if the doctor, the ER, would have accepted it. This just sets a guideline of the information that would be required.
Are you tired?
I'm sure. Hey, almost 5 o'clock.
I think it's a good idea.
No, I like this. Madam Chair, I would suggest that you and I maybe bring in, I clearly don't want to involve DHS in this, but DHS does understand this sort of thing, and maybe the best way to go about keeping it out of their hands but making sure the protections are there. And I'm getting some nodding that you might be
I got an okay. email. I actually sent this to them before I dropped the bill saying, is this legal? I mean, would we have problems? And they said they would. They didn't indicate. They emailed back
I think, Lori, if we had them help us make sure that the language is right and we're getting at what we're supposed to get after here, I think that would be appropriate at this point, and we can make that happen. So, good idea, though, I think.
Okay.
So, any other questions of the chair? Because she doesn't like questions, you know that. I do have one question. Really, no more pork bellies?
They went away.
Frozen,
I remember it was a big news story because they were the classic trading item, and they went away. They were taken off of the. There's a term. I'm not remembering the name of the Chicago.
The commodities exchange. Right.
Thank you. They were
one of the main components.
I know that, and that's why it was such a big.
Are you going
story.
To
Would
adjourn?
You like to adjourn?
Yes.
I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 601, and we are adjourned.